I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Our guest this hour is the author of Language at the Speed of Sight, How We Read, Why So Many Can't, and What Can Be Done About It. He is a psychologist, a psycholinguist, and a cognitive neuroscientist who's been studying reading since, he says, the disco era. Mark Seidenberg is a professor in the Department of Psychology at UW-Madison, and we are delighted to talk to him about reading. I wasn't aware that so many of us don't read very well at all, so why is that? How is it that we read in the first place? When do we start reading, and what happens? It's a very complex process. What happens inside our brains, and does all of this information that we're getting about the science of the brain give us instruction as to how we should be teaching reading in schools? We'll talk about all of that this hour and welcome phone calls for Dr. Seidenberg. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. I would imagine we'll get more than a few phone calls on this. A lot of people struggle with reading, and we have lots of different ideas about how to teach reading. Again, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can find us on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Mark Seidenberg, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Glad to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you here. We'll have a great hour. So you got me thinking about, which I must say I never thought about before. I don't know why. But when did we start reading? We talked before we started reading and writing, I know. But when did we start reading and why?
Oh, well, this is one of the great achievements of human history.
Yeah.
And it's also one of the great puzzles because we've got records of when writing appeared. They're very scattered. They're very incomplete. And it's very hard to piece together exactly where and exactly when and exactly who was involved. But we can see what a lot of the steps were. And we're talking about something that really comes along in human history very recently. We're talking about 4,000 years ago, which isn't long. And that's when the first writing, early partial writing systems start to appear, and then it takes really 2,000 to 3,000 years more to figure it out and kind of perfect it to get to the kinds of systems we have today that are workable.
Mm-hmm. You say in the book that a snapshot of a person's brain activity while reading shows that most of the brain is involved. It's complex, huh?
Of course. You know, Kathleen, do your listeners find it surprising that the brain is mostly involved with most activities? Because it's true in general, and it's certainly true of reading. For one thing, a good part of the brain is simply involved with the visual system and language, and reading, of course, uses both of those. But many other things are involved, too. There's learning, and there's memory, and there's motivation and affect and thinking. So, yes, of course, when we read, it's recruiting most of our brain to achieve this wonderful thing that we can do.
Mm-hmm. And I would imagine in your area, tell me how many breakthroughs have there been, say, in the last 10 or 20 years about what's happening in the brain, about all the scientific studies that have been done concerning how we read, how we learn to read, how we should learn to read?
Well, I think reading is is one of the oldest topics in research psychology. It goes back to the 19th century. And for decades, the main evidence that we had was from people's behavior. We would look at children's behavior very carefully, and we would look at adults' behavior. We would look at people who were struggling and who were doing well. There's a community of scientists around the world who study reading. So it's been examined in many languages that have different kinds of writing systems. I mean, we have a huge amount of behavioral data, just data that we could measure in relatively simply. Well, then neuroimaging techniques and other related techniques have come along, and they are a big help because there are things about reading that you just are very hard to pick up, even from very careful behavioral studies. And so the brain provides a new source of evidence. And, of course, along the way, we're figuring out how the circuits that support reading develop, how they're related to language and vision and other capacities, the kinds of things that determine whether a child, these circuits develop to support skilled reading or whether the child encounters difficulties. I would say the reading is an area where the neuroimaging kind of measurements have been enormously helpful. And I would say really over the last five, six years, there's been a big jump in how much we've learned. Mm. So if you combine that with all the behavioral data that we've had for decades, there's just a lot to work for.
Mm-hmm. And it's not translating to the classroom, which we'll get to in a moment. I'm thinking about all of the languages that are spoken on this earth and wondering if you talk about reading levels in the U.S. being so low, and please tell us how low they are, but I'm wondering if there's something about our written language that makes it more difficult to learn to read. Are there other countries where the language, it makes translating from the written word to being able to understand that easier?
I think the basic answer is no, because I devoted part of the book to this. I've looked at it pretty carefully. There are trade-offs. And so what looks easy in one language and in one writing system may trade off against something else that's more complicated. So the net effect is that there are a lot of different kinds of writing systems that work, that can be learned, that are effective, and it's not that the particular problems that we have in this country are because we happen to read written English. Written English has a bad reputation, and I could tell you a bit about it. It's a little exaggerated. We have, you know, we're notorious for having words that whose pronunciations are unpredictable. Why is have pronounced have, and why is give pronounced give? It should be give.
Right.
And we get a bad reputation for that. But there's other benefits too. Those words are short. They're very common, and our English has English grammar is simpler in some ways than other languages, and so we end up having shorter words that are easier to learn. And so the fact that there are those irregularities, they're only partial. Have overlaps with a lot of other words. Give overlaps with other words. So, you know, have, H-A-V-E, isn't pronounced glorp. So children can learn them with reasonable instruction and experience. So superficially, it does look like there are other writing systems that are easier. In Finnish, for example, the correspondences between the print and the sound are much more consistent. Hmm. But Finnish has a much more complicated way of forming words than we do. And those Finnish kids really need to get into the basics of reading quickly, because they're going to be spending a lot longer than our kids learning how the grammar of that language works. So there's no free lunch. These factors trade off, and you know English is learnable. There are countries like Canada and Australia, New Zealand that do better than us in terms of teaching people, Canada in particular, and they also have English as to cope with. So right. Let's not blame the writing system.
Okay. You begin the book talking about, as soon as people find out what you do for a living and what your special area is, they talk to you about reading. And a surprising number of people who are superintendents, people who are lawyers, a lot of people who are pretty high-to-do professionals have said that they struggle with reading. They feel they're very slow readers. They have a hard time reading. The reading levels in the U.S. are very low. So there's something at play here, because everybody would like to be able to read and comprehend and read rapidly. And not everybody, but most of us would like to be able to read as much as we can, because there is so much to know, for heaven's sake. So why? Tell me how low the levels are and how so many people have become lawyers, et cetera, and feel that they can't read very well.
Well, there's two issues there. One is many people feel that other people read much more quickly than they do. So there's a kind of distorted sense of what the norm is for reading. In the book, I joke that, you know, reading is the area that's the opposite of Lake Wobegon, because, you know, it's where everybody is below average.
Right, yeah.
And the point about the lawyers and the school superintendent examples, which were real ones, is that people tend to think everyone else reads more quickly. And I think this is unrealistic. And in fact, it's because they have a distorted sense of how fast people can read. And in fact, what they're probably describing is normal, careful reading, which is not actually necessarily a speedy process. And so people can feel that their reading is below average or that it is slow, and they can certainly want to read much more quickly because, my goodness, that would be a superpower if you could read 10 times as fast as your current rate. But a lot of people who are perfectly good readers nonetheless feel like they are not, and that's a bit of an illusion. That's a bit of a mistake. That's different from the percentage of kids and then later adults in the country who really are poor readers. And there's always been and continues to be a very large percentage of the population whose reading skills are minimal at best.
Mm-hmm. You also quote Philip Roth, who talks, and I'm interested in your thoughts about this, the evidence is everywhere that the literary era has come to an end. The evidence is the culture, the society, the screen, the progression from the movie screen to the TV screen to the computer. Literature takes a habit of mind that has disappeared. Is that true?
Well, I can't say whether it's true. I think that was Philip Roth, who's a novelist. And, of course, what kinds of reading people choose to do is something that may vary, and it can change. And I think he was referring specifically to literature. It may be that literature, I don't know, is literature any less important now than it was 40 years ago? He thinks so, but... My more general question would be about reading for whatever purposes you want to or need to, and that will include literature, that will include education and on the job and being able to teach your children and other things. Mm-hmm. So I share his concern, but he might have been overstating things a little bit just because he's thinking about literature, high literature in particular.
There is a remarkable consensus, you write, among scientists, and this has been widely studied all over the world, about the basic theory of how reading works and the causes and of reading successes and failures. So, what are the causes?
Well, how much of a story would you like?
Well, give us as much as you'd like. We have some time.
There are a couple of major ingredients. This discussion is just about kids who don't have some obvious kind of impairment that's really interfering with their development and with the development of reading. So we're talking about typical kids and the factors that influence who becomes a reader and what influences how skillful they become. One thing is that reading starts with spoken language. So the biggest determinant of children's progress into reading, getting into reading in the early grades and getting on the path to being a skilled reader, is their spoken language experience. So reading starts with spoken language. And spoken language is the child's knowledge of a spoken language from birth until they begin to read, which depends on their environment, who talks to them, how they're talked to, the language abilities of the people in their daycare or their preschool, in the household. Spoken language is a huge determinant of children's progress into reading. The kids' problem is they already know a spoken language, and now they're going to be exposed to print. And they have to build a new bridge from print into this knowledge of spoken language they already know. They already know how to speak. So if they can just figure out how this written code links up to what they already know about spoken language, they'll be able to read.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big obstacle, and getting past that is a really big deal. It depends on their spoken language experience. We know that kids' vocabularies and their familiarity with sentence structures and things varies hugely. That has an impact on making progress. And we know that instruction matters. What happens in the what happens in the home before the kids goes to school, and what happens in the early grades in school really has a big impact on helping the kid to connect print to what they already know about speech. So I would start by thinking about reading as building that bridge into spoken language, and if we want to have kids, be able to do that, we need to build their spoken language and then help them build that bridge.
Mm-hmm. How did you learn to read?
You know, my mother lives here in Madison, and there we've had some discussion about this. She thinks, of course, that era, which was a while ago, didn't involve quite as much parental involvement, and there wasn't as much teaching, you know, reading to the children in the home. I think she made it clear that reading was important and that there were books available and that it was going to be something I was going to do. But I learned to read in school, and I picked it up pretty quickly. But, you know, some kids need a little bit more help. Some need less. The exact teaching method that they used, I read Dick and Jane books.
So did I.
Dick and Jane books were supposed to be ones that had limited vocabulary that the child could learn to read just by kind of memorizing the words. So that's why they had, you know, all those repetitions of, see, Dick, run, run, Dick, run.
I know.
Something no one would do today, of course. But we managed, right? We learned to read.
Yes, we
and
did.
It didn't ruin us. And indeed, you know, we wouldn't use those methods today. But something happened in school, and most of us made that transition into reading, which is really the first big hump that the kid has to get through. And if they get off to a fast start, then they can move ahead.
So what's the profound disconnection that you write about between the science of reading and the educational practice?
Well, you know, reading is of interest to many people from various perspectives. Scientists think of it as a kind of intelligent behavior that's really complex and interesting, so we want to understand it. And we're interested in learning. And reading is interesting for itself. However, it's also this skill that people can have that is enormously important. So we try to understand how reading from this certain kind of perspective. There's a parallel approach within education that views it somewhat differently. The science isn't really taken into account. In fact, it's pretty actively pushed away. And we think the research shows that there are, the kid's path into reading can be difficult. That first transition is really a crucial thing where kids need help, where instruction and guidance and feedback is crucial. And on the education side, you have a different sort of philosophy, which is kind of setting up a situation in which you focus on the goal. The goal is that the child be literate, that the child be in love books and be able to benefit from them, mm-hmm. and enjoy them. And so focus on the goal, and if you have an environment in which the child's motivation is high and the literacy environment is enriching, the child will figure out how to get from not being a reader to reading. And the science says something very different. The science says, no, it actually took thousands of years for people to figure out how to develop writing systems and how to get them to work. And we don't want children rediscovering that. We want to actually give the kids some explicit guidance that helps them make the connection between print and sound so that they can go on to other sorts of literacy activities. So we have two different worldviews. We have two different communities. It's kind of two different cultures. And the barriers are unfortunately pretty high and have been in place for quite a long time. I go through a lot of the history of the book. It goes back to, you know, the creation of the education schools in the early 20th century. So this has been going on for a long time, and it means that we're missing some opportunities. We're missing the opportunity to connect the science to the practices that would make it better for more kids.
And obviously the two schools that we've been hearing about, maybe there are other schools now, would be whole language instruction or phonetic instruction. What do you recommend? Is there something beyond that?
I think those terms really don't capture the difference. So everybody's probably familiar with the reading wars. The reading wars were billed as, you know, people who thought about phonics. So phonics just refers to certain kinds of methods for helping the kid figure out how print relates to spoken language. And then this other approach called whole language, which kind of focused on literacy and basically said, if you focus on the mechanics, you know, how the letters and print relates to sound and all that, the phonics and that kind of thing, you're going to extinguish the kids' interest in reading before they even get started. So it's been publicized as a kind of phonics versus this other kind of approach. But actually, the differences are quite a bit deeper. And phonics is really only an element of it. Phonics, schmonics. I mean, some kids need more, some kids need less. The point is that you have to do something to make sure that the kid makes this transition into reading so that they can then benefit from lots of other activities. You can't skip over it. In the current era, no one believes in either of those. Everyone is for balanced literacy. Balanced literacy was the way that the reading wars came to an end. It said, use the best of both. Don't be dogmatic. Nobody has the perfect answer, and it basically left it up to the teacher to figure out what combination of methods would be best for them and for their particular kids. And what that did was it basically was a way to quiet down the debate, but didn't really address the underlying issues. And so the reading wars ended without resolving the issues about instruction that really had led to them, and things have not improved because of that.
Hmm. Well, we'll talk about how we improve them and what is the best way to teach reading as we carry on, because most of us do learn to read in school. Our guest is Mark Seidenberg. The book is Language at the Speed of Sight, How We Read, Why So Many Can't, and What Can Be Done About It. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. We're on Facebook at The Kathleen Dunn Show and Twitter at K Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network. Many phone calls coming in and messages for our guest. And let's go to Radley in Minocqua first. Hi, Radley.
Hi, thanks for the show.
Sure.
I was calling in because I have a learning disability, which has made it difficult for me to read, which is I can read, but I'm just really slow, and I'm a pretty bad proofreader of my own material, especially. But it's been very frustrating because being labeled learning disabled, there's the way they determine that is I've had a high IQ. I have a high IQ. It was in the 97th percentile, and I made it through graduate school in the sciences, and I've published in scientific journals and even wrote a book. Still, reading is very challenging, and if someone just hands me print material and expects me to scan it and give them back the information, I can't do that. But the reason I'm calling is because my unfortunate daughter received the same trait from me, and she's about 10 years old and is just scratching the surface of reading. And remembering what it was like to be a student going through that and struggling and the kind of humiliation of it all, and seeing her, who's a very bright young lady and loves audiobooks and can devour them and has the best retention in her class and a wonderful vocabulary, but just can't read. I'm just wondering what sort of advice you have for people who are wired differently and where can we turn for help? Because I know I was born in the 70s and things have come a long way, but the school's really not getting her where she needs to be.
I'm so glad you called. It's a good question.
Listener, I'm glad to hear that you've made it as with having stuck with it and gotten to where you are. And you know, dyslexia is heritable, highly heritable, so it runs in families for sure. And, you know, the question is whether the schools do deal with it differently now than they did when you were in the growing up. So, unfortunately, this is one of the areas where education and science really differ. So, on the science side, there's been a huge amount of progress in terms of understanding reading difficulties and how they arise and the ways that reading difficulties sometimes co-occur with other kinds of problems, like attentional difficulties. There's a lot known about the development of the brain structures. There's a lot known about interventions that are effective with many children. On the education side, there's a debate about whether dyslexia exists. The argument is something like dyslexia is just poor reading and teachers are supposed to always deal with children whose reading skills vary. It's their job to try to tailor their instructional practices to the needs of the kid. And so identifying a kid as dyslexic doesn't really help. I think that's wrong. So you're an example and your daughter are examples of people who need additional help in order to make use of their other skills and be able to read at a reasonable level and possibly become quite good readers. And so it's putting an unreasonable burden on the classroom teacher to be able to manage that along with a classroom. And moreover, the classroom teacher is very unlikely to have had any training that would be really relevant. They are more likely to be told that dyslexia doesn't exist. There are some very, very prominent educators who say that dyslexia is a hoax. It is something that was made up by educators to excuse their bad teaching. This is not right. Now, the question for you would be, is the child's reading problem recognized by the schools? Does the school have reading specialists or other people with particular kinds of expertise who can help this child get the additional assistance that she needs? Because there are things that can be done, as I say, that are effective with many, many children, especially a kid like yours who sounds like she has a lot of other things going for her. So the question, though, is she getting the help that she needs? And my general message to parents would be, you cannot assume that the schools will take care of it. There are various reasons why they may not or probably will not. And it probably will require going outside the schools to find people who have a great deal of experience dealing with kids who struggle with reading. I'd also say it's better to try to get to them when they're young than when they're older. It's easier to deal with, and the success rate is higher. So, caller, can she get help in the schools? If not, can she get help in the community from a reading specialist, a cognitive neuropsychologist, someone who has experience dealing with other kids like her and can provide assistance that she's probably not going to get in the classroom?
So do you have hope that she will be able to get that kind of help in the classroom? There must be enough people. Scientists are studying this all over the world, you among them. So there must be some way to get some of these experts who can help people, and there are many of them, if our reading levels are so low, to learn how to read.
There's a disconnect, though. It's not something that my belief is that the school systems should be dealing with all children, and that the teachers, I'm not blaming the teachers here, the teachers need to have the skills to have been prepared for the job so that they can help us do the best job that they can with as many kids as possible. Now, that doesn't happen. But beyond that, there are kids who need extra help that is going to be difficult to provide in a classroom. And that means we need reading specialists, people who really understand the kinds of things I talk about in the book and can turn it into activities and practices and so on that will help children. And so then the question is access. If you're a middle class or upper middle class individual with a good school system or in a better off community, then it's likely they'll be able to pay someone to provide these extra services, to provide this extra help.
Right.
And that works for many people. Unfortunately, that discriminates against the kids from lower income backgrounds who won't be able to go outside the school to get this additional help because the family doesn't have the resources.
Bradley, do you have resources inside your daughter's school or in your community in Minocqua?
Yes, we do. We have a very good school system, and my daughter does meet with a reading specialist on a daily basis.
Great, good.
And so this isn't straightforward. My learning disability wasn't dyslexia. It was some sort of symbolic sequence disability, which is really interesting. Apparently, sheet music would be hard for me to learn, and I'm good at some types of math, but algebra, where you have symbols, my brain just and eyes don't consume the information the same way. So I'm gathering hers is probably the same. Mm-hmm. The school has identified her needs, and the reading specialist has said, boy, she's one of the hardest cases we've dealt with. She does go to a public charter school, so it learns in a little different approach than your kid sitting in a row. And they've been able to, one of the big differences between what we did in the 70s, what they do now is in the 70s, they'd take you out into special classrooms and keep you there. And now she gets to consume her information in a different way, and she may actually be the one leading the discussion because of her retention of information. So there's neat ways to put kids back into the classroom so they can help teach other kids or contribute to the discussion anyway, where that wasn't happening in the past. So I guess my big question is who are these neuropsychologists I turn to get the extra help that we're really going to need? Because the reading specialists at school are dealing with lots of different children, and it's hard for them to go deep. It's not that the schools are bad around here or her specialists aren't paying attention.
Well, I obviously wouldn't speak to the particular circumstances either in your child's school or her own profile or anything, but basically there are organizations in this state that will point you to specialists who are reasonable. So I could give you the names of some. There's the Wisconsin Reading Coalition. These people all have websites, of course. There's the Wisconsin branch of the International Dyslexia Association. Even if her child isn't exactly dyslexic, maybe she's, you know, people vary. But the folks at these organizations can know where the people are, know where the specialists are, know where you could get reliable help, and keep you away from the crackpots. And it's like getting a physician. It's like getting any other kind of health care. You have to go and find the experts who have some skill and have dealt with a lot of kids and gained a lot of different tools.
Thank you so much, Radley, for your call. Let's go to Sue in Stoughton next. Hi, Sue. Sue, are you there? Well, Sue isn't there. Call us back in case you were somewhere else, and just call us back. Let's go to a couple messages on Facebook. Kate on Facebook says, I think it's parents who can't tell their children no when it comes to technology. Some of them are in front of the tube or gaming from the time they get home until the time they go to bed. Parents welcome it because they can relax if their child is content. Also, if you're interested, talk to your children about what their reading libraries are free.
Well, of course, this is a huge issue. It's not, and you know, there are distractions. There are distractions that have, you know, much shorter learning curves and much faster payoffs. You know, much more pleasure with much less effort. And they're you know, these have been around a long time, but now there's more. I would recommend looking. My book talks a bit about that, but for real hardcore, how do I manage this so that my kid becomes a reader? I'd recommend looking at books by someone else, namely Dan Willingham. Dan Willingham is a scientist and educator, very connected with teacher groups and the classroom, and his books really are very good on, okay, what are we going to do to try to get these kids reading, and what are we going to do about the distractions and so on? So I really would take a look at Dan Willingham's books for some guidance. These are tough problems. And the only other thing I'd add is screens could be used for good because, you know, you can do a lot of reading on screens. It's not, you know, a tween who's texting 4,000 text a month and they're all three words long, or they're all, you know, K. But screens can be a source of reading enrichment. And the fact that the reading is tied to listening and video and stuff like that, that can be great. The problem is kind of the low literacy, literacy light activities. And so I try to really exploit the good stuff about the screen-based activities to promote reading. And that it's a tough thing to balance for sure.
Mm-hmm. Chuck in Green Bay, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Not too bad.
Go right ahead.
Well, shouldn't reading start with proper with the child when the child is starting to develop their cognition of verbs of words. I'm a pretty simple man, but when I was growing up, and the vocabulary that was given to me was not really a good vocabulary until I got straightened out when I was in college. And then, I mean, the word have, you know, I always use the word have because that's the way it was told to me. You have to do this, you know. Instead of have, H-A-V-E, I was writing half, H-A-L-F.
Oh.
And, you know, I wasn't straightened out until I, you know, until my professors was reading my, notes or something that I had to, you know, provide. And then they were correcting my language.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't know that, you know, you don't have to do that. It's have, H-A-V-E, and I was corrected on it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I just from where I lived in Michigan, and they all talk that way.
Professor Seidenberg.
Well, you raise a really interesting point about something that does occur, not just to you, but it does happen quite a lot. So, first of all, I'm really sorry you didn't get more feedback and help earlier because I'm sure you would have benefited from it. One of the things you point out is that not everybody speaks English exactly the same way, and not everybody has the same, we don't all have the same pronunciations, and we don't have exactly the same grammar. There's some differences. And for many people, the language that they're used to speaking in the home and in the community, which is just fine language, there's nothing wrong with it, doesn't match up exactly with the language that they then encounter in school. So the books are written in, you know, this kind of standard way, and the teacher is probably going to be emphasizing this standard way. And so when there is this difference between, whether it's pronunciations or something, vocabulary, other things, when there's this difference between the language, it's dialect, really, the manner of speaking that the child has learned in the home and community, which is perfectly valid and perfectly useful, when it differs from what's expected in the school, that's another hurdle. And educational practices can take that into account. They can take into account that the child, yourself, for example, was also not just learning how to read and do arithmetic, they were also learning about this school English thing. And you can focus on that, and you can bring the kid up to speed pretty quickly because young kids are good language learners. However, you have to be aware that there's an issue. And it sounds like the people, when you were growing up and in when you were young, people weren't aware that there was an issue. And it wasn't built into the educational practices. So that is another issue I take up in the book. It's still a problem for a lot of people. It's still something, another thing that we could be doing better with in terms of how we deal with it in class.
Mm-hmm. You write in the book that we know which behaviors of 3 and 4 year olds predict later reading ability. What are those behaviors?
Oh, it's such those studies. I didn't do them. Some very, very tenacious researchers did studies in which they started looking at children, infants and toddlers. So you look at children when they're very young and you track them for 5, 8, 10 years. You find out some of them become strong readers and some of them have reading problems. And then you can go back and see what was it that happened. What was it about their behavior when they were an infant or a toddler or just before they started school that was behind, that was the signal, the sign that they were actually on their way to struggling with reading. So there are studies that looked at children's responses to sounds and to speech within 36 hours of birth. 36 hours. I could tell you the methods, but they're not, they don't hurt the baby or anything. They're just listening, recording some the child's, infant's responses to sounds. In children who are at risk for dyslexia because there's a family history, you see atypical brain responses to sound in children within 36 hours of birth. And those deficits were then shown to be linked to a variety of steps along the way as the kid grew older. When they were toddlers, it's things like their ability to learn the names of letters and to learn the sounds of letters. When they're a little bit older, it's things like being able to tell if things rhyme. When they are just starting school and pre-readers, they probably will still have problems. They may not know all of their letters, and they may show other impairments and slight impairments in their ability to process spoken language. So their vocabularies may be smaller. It may have an impact on their learning complex grammar, etc. So we have been able, scientists have been able to track things that are strongly predictive of good outcomes and poorer outcomes, starting with measurements very shortly after the child has been born. Mm-hmm. And these are things that really matter. Vocabulary, spoken language experience, child's ability to respond to speech and so on are things that are really crucial.
Mark Seidenberg, author of Language at the Speed of Sight, How We Read, Why So Many Can't, and What Can Be Done About It. Mark is a professor in the Department of Psychology at UW-Madison. He's a cognitive neuroscientist and has studied language, reading, and dyslexia for a number of years. More phone calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network. And let's go back to phone calls. Grace in New Glarus. Hi.
Hey, thank you for getting me on.
Mm-hmm.
Couple of things. Number one, I'm a retired epidemiologist, worked for the federal government. I have mild dyslexia. It came about after some head injuries and also the development of a gluten intolerance that affects my brain functioning. It's worst when I'm tired, when I've been eating food that contains gluten. I confuse P's, Q's, and G's, lowercase P's, Q's, and G's, D's, and B's. I also confuse some numerals with letters. I was giving a account code. When I was working on my PhD, I was giving an account code to the folks at the computer store one day. And they looked at me and said, that one doesn't make sense. And I said, oh, wait a minute. How about if you replace the 5 with a D, 5 with an S and the 2 with a D? And they said, yep, that works. But I have a really strong concern. I don't know what's happened with rates of dyslexia in this country in the last 20, 30 years. When I was a kid, you know, 10 years old or so, I knew kids who had dyslexia. So I, unlike a couple of people might have intimated, I know it's been around for quite a while. I am extremely concerned with the rates of attention deficit disorder and autism that we are seeing in our children now. So I'd like to hear about what's happened with rates of dyslexia over the last 20 to 50 years, 10 years even. I'm concerned about the use of plastics in our foods. We know that compounds in plastics, which are primarily petroleum derivatives, have significant impacts on our endocrine systems, our immune systems, our neurological systems. 20 years ago, you did not see ketchup and other stuff that has to be processed hot in plastic bottles. And now we do. Cans, that food, soups, baby, whatever comes in, are lined with plastic. We know that this is having an effect on our animals because in some parts of the world, pet food cans can't be lined with plastic. And you don't see certain diseases in those areas that we see routinely here in our pets. What's it doing to us? So I would love to see and it would have to be a large, well-funded epidemiological study that looks at parts of the world where plastics are being used for food, for lining cans, for having sauces and soups and everything in plastic, and areas of the world where that isn't happening. You know, the United States versus places that don't rely on packaged foods the way we do.
Dr. Seidenberg.
I can't speak to that particular theory about the influence of that kind of environmental agent, though we do know there are environmental toxins. And in reading, there is no evidence that the rate of dyslexia is increasing. What is happening is more, in some areas, people are more aware of it, and so more kids are being screened and more kids are being identified. But that doesn't mean the rate is going up. The biggest environmental concern I would have is about children in lower income neighborhoods where the toxins include lead paint, where the impact on brain function and development is very well established, and indeed there are very clear studies already in place indicating how such agents affect brain function, not just for reading, but brain development more generally. I am, however, skeptical that plastics are the particular agent that is underlying reading problems in this country, because there are simpler explanations, namely various aspects of how children are taught, and rather mild impairments in their ability to process auditory signals that don't have a huge impact on other behaviors but happen to affect reading, because reading is a complicated skill and has a lot of moving parts. So you don't have to be systematically poisoned to have reading problems, though that does indeed happen in some cases. My concern would be to certainly screen kids and identify to the best of our ability what their strengths and weaknesses are, and build on them.
And thank you, Grace, for the call. Cindy is next in Sauk City. Hi, Cindy.
Hello. I do actually agree with Grace, but we're a country that uses television for entertainment for not only our babies but toddlers. And I'm just wondering, is there any correlations that you have found with way too much television watching that may affect reading skills?
I don't really study it because I'm interested in more basic questions about how reading works. If the child isn't, here's one thing. I mean, reading is a skill that depends on the amount that you do. And so there's an amount of time on task, and whether what you're reading is at your current level or slightly above it, which is good. And so things that take away from your time spent on reading won't be helpful. On the other hand, people have learned to read with television and with screens and with other distractions. And so It all depends. The child's got to do some, got to be reading and has to be able to be successful enough to continue to be motivated to read. The one thing I would point out is that children don't learn from television the way they learn from other people. It's not as effective. And so, even having somebody on television reading a book, which is a nice thing for the child to watch, and maybe positive in some regard, is not as effective in terms of what the child learns as a person reading and interacting with that child.
And Mark, on that note, we have to say goodbye because we're out of time. Thank you very much for being with us.
Sure, it's my pleasure.
Mark Seidenberg, the book is Language at the Speed of Sight: How We Read, Why So Many Can't, and What Can Be Done About It. Thanks to Marika Saval for producing the hour and to Colleen Duvall for on-air production here in our studios. On Monday, we'll have a new president, and we'll be speaking with Francesca Chambers for our All Things Political segment. There'll be a lot to discuss politically on Monday at 1 o'clock. Thanks for listening.